I'm at the top of my field. That's a cat.
Oh, wow. What a song. It just gets me right in the mood to talk about some science.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's so smooth and jazzy, a little bit sexy, and you're like, ooh, you know what'd be great right now? Some questions some no science. One asked. Some science.
No one asked, yes.
Some answers to questions that no one needed asked. To know, no one wanted to know, but we're and telling yet, you anyways.
Here we are. So my mom and dad just discovered today that our first podcast went live last week. And
hilarious.
They listened to it. They actually enjoyed it. And they they sent the link to my grandmother, who also enjoyed it. So I think we're doing pretty good.
Wow. Yeah.
We have seal of approval.
Yeah, honestly, the Quincy family seal of approval is what I've been waiting for.
I know.
Because let's be real, like, my mom listens to it, she's gonna be like, oh, you girls are so smart, I love you, you know? Which I appreciate. I appreciate the endless love and support. But but it's really your mom that, like, she would tell us. Yeah.
Yeah. Love and support from her is, like, exciting.
Yeah, right? Because you never know which direction it's going to come from. And, like, at the end of the day, you do feel loved and supported. But you never know how. You're like, ooh. Like,
just so any listeners know, my mom is very loving and supporting. But, like, she's not a terrible person. But
No. She's just brutally honest about Yeah, like, correct, my mom has those, like, rose-colored lenses where, like, she claims she's brutally honest about when I mess something up, but, like, her definition of when I mess something up is, like, so much more lenient than any other objective definition.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, so I'm your, gentle viewers, I am your host, Elsa. This is your host, Quincy, and this is our podcast, But Why?
Where we answer the questions no one asked.
No one asked. And this week we're going to be telling you about evolution because it is so much fun to talk about evolution.
It is such a huge topic, just so you know. So this will not be the only episode on it because there is far too much to explain.
Oh, far too much. Far, far too much. Yeah, this is the first of many. This is the intro.
And from here on out, like, Elsa's taking the reins on the evolution talks, and each episode we're going to kind of flip back and forth between, like, running the conversation. So, Elsa, this one's all yours. How was researching for this? Was it fun?
Oh, my gosh. Researching for this was I almost didn't get to do enough research, just because, as I mentioned last podcast episode, I've taken a class on evolution, so I had all my class notes. So, in terms of, like, telling you guys where my sources are from, most of my sources are from class notes, and, like, sometimes I would go in and, like, Google and, like, find the facts that, like, we used in class and be like, oh, this is from, like, NCBI or something like that. But it was so much fun to read over my notes. It was so much fun to, like, get into, like, the nitty-gritty and the examples and stuff, because honestly, at the end of the day, once you get past the whole, like, oh, like, this goes against my values, and when you actually, like, learn about what this is, it's like, it doesn't actually conflict with anyone's values, it won't, you know what I mean? So at the end of the day, it's just learning about cool facts, and it's learning about cool facts about animals, and how the environment affects us, and just how, like, this whole world is kind of interconnected with itself, and it's just a good time.
And when Elsa says that she didn't have enough time to research, that means that she's basically searched all of the internet, all of her class notes ever. She just hasn't had time to sit down with every leading scientist and discuss it with them.
I mean, accurate?
Yeah. Like, she definitely has enough notes.
Oh, for sure. Oh, I have, like, 9 pages of notes here, and I've already, like, highlighted the stuff that I'm actually going to talk about because I know 9 pages is too many.
Yeah. Like, when Elsa says that versus when I say that, it's like, I actually skimmed through Wikipedia, like, the day of a test, and she's like, I have read everything there is to read on it. I just haven't done the interviews yet.
Oh, man, I feel so called out, and yet so accurately so.
It's a compliment, Elsa.
Thank you. I definitely go for the deets. I'm definitely detail-oriented. Alrighty, Quincy. So you know how I'm going to start this whole thing? Is I'm going to start talking about history, because this is a science podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if that's quite on topic, but I think I know where you're going.
Well, I'm going to just start by giving you the history of kind of the study of biology a little bit, and I'm going to briefly compare it to the study of physics, just to give you an idea of how we got here. Because right now, as we know, evolution is quite controversial, depending on which country you're in, because there's this hot, like, there's this heavy religious element to it where Catholic religion feels like evolution contradicts their idea of God. And then so there's that kind of debate of like, this can't be true. The scientists are like, yo, this is like really just true. And so there's a huge debate. So I'm going to talk about how we got there, because in like, we have hints of evolution as far back as the 6th century BC. So in 6th century BC, a guy named Anaximander suggests that we are all made of water, so that we all have this kind of common ancestor where we all come from water. And that's the first kind of written suggestion of this idea of evolution, that we all come from this one place and we've evolved from there.
I gotta say that it seems to me that people with the coolest names are always the ones that come up with the coolest ideas. Like, there's no Gary in history who, like, who said this really intelligent thing about evolution. Sorry, Dad. That's my dad's name, by the way.
Yeah, you know what? You are totally right. Because I'm reading over my little names here. And the next guy I'm going to mention is Plato. And then I'm going to mention Aristotle. And, like, they all have dope names.
I know. It's crazy. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, so after Anaximander suggests that we're all made of water, 4th century BC, Plato suggests this idea of la scala natura, which basically means a natural scale or progression of organisms. So Plato starts suggesting, this is going to become very, you'll see where this kind of goes to, but Plato suggests that there is a hierarchy of organisms, and that you can in fact rank organisms by their just goodness or how they relate to God. So that's gonna become a problem later. 3rd century BC, we got our bro Aristotle, and he has this idea that there's a fixed essence. So it's the idea that an organism has a single perfect form. So we'll see this later with Da Vinci, where he draws like the perfect proportions of man and stuff like that. And this concept that comes from 3rd century BC will really evolve in Judeo-Christian religion as the idea that God created the perfect form, that like human is the perfect form and it was created that way. He thinks that human is the result of this perfect form creation. So there will be some men who are the perfect examples of men, because of course, you know, if you rank the organisms, like, man comes before women. Right. So that there are men who are born with this perfect form, and that shows that they are touched by God with these like perfect proportions. But it's just the general idea that like the general shape of a human is this ideal shape that has been predetermined.
That's what actually ends up leading to animal abuse, isn't it? Because of this perfect form and everything else is less superior than us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is going to lead to a lot of really bad things. Most like notably is in Victorian times, this kind of idea evolves into this, what's called the Great Chain of Being. Now, the Great Chain of Being is a ranked system that ranks animals in terms of closeness to God, right?
So right.
It's like the close, there is a ranking system. Animals and organisms all fall into this ranking system, and it's ranked as according to how close you are to God. So humans are at the top of, like, so it goes God, and then it goes angels, and then it goes humans. And within that, like, it's super racist. So within that, you go in and you're like, a white man is the best type, and then a white woman, and then it lists the races, and it's not a good time at all.
Right. It's so funny, eh? How like the people who make the scale are the ones who are like at the top.
Yeah, convenient, right?
Yeah, very, very convenient. Not objective or biased at all.
No, it's like being like, I discovered this crown. That makes me king. Like, wait a second. So interestingly, I think this kind of explains why we revere lions so much, because lions, if you actually study them, are dickheads. But according to this Great Chain of Being, the lion is the best of the animals. The lion is the closest to God that an animal can be. Of course, the male lion. Even though male lions are dickheads.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, so are humans. So I guess maybe the scale's just on like the biggest dickheads to the smallest dickheads.
Oh my God, maybe they accidentally ranked dickheadishness.
They forgot. That's what they were actually doing.
That's what they were really doing. Oh my God, Quincy, we just cracked this case.
We cracked it. Someone called the press.
So just to give you kind of a degree to which this was believed, like this was intrinsic in beliefs that like this is idea of like how close you are to God, is that doctors at this time believed that men had one less rib than women because Adam cut off his rib to make woman, right?
Dude, I was still taught that at church when I was going through church. And I was like, what?
Wait, really?
Oh my God, yeah. I was taught that when I was a kid.
Oh my God. See, I also grew up being raised, quote unquote, I say quote unquote raised, Catholic, and we went to church and stuff like that. But I must admit, true to Elsa fashion, I just did not listen. I was so bored all the time. I didn't understand what they were talking about. I didn't care. I would like bring a little toy and I would like play with my toy the whole time.
Oh my God. No, I was very, very attentive, but I could teach you some stuff, man.
Oh, could you teach me the real ways of the world, Quincy?
No, let's keep going.
So that is all just to give you a little sense of that is how the they're just going to evolve into the study of biology. So that's how our thoughts progress. And I'm going to just break away from bio a little bit to talk about physics, just to tell you how physics is evolving, just to give you a little bit like of a different perspective. Because one of the reasons why bio is so stunted in terms of like scientific study and acceptance of like some things that have been very supported in the scientific field, is that almost everything that way back when here in the, like now I'm going to start talking about the 1400s, 1500s, everything that you discover about bio has to not contradict the Bible. So Nicholas Copernicus,
great name.
So he was born in 1473, he died in 1543, and somewhere in his lifetime, he came up with the advanced heliocentric solar system model. Basically being like, yo, the Earth is not in the center. Which I know we think of Galileo Galilei is doing that. Galileo Galilei is born in 1564, so a little bit after Copernicus dies, and he dies in 1642, and he comes up with the elliptic solar system. So the fact that it's not a perfect circle and stuff like that. So they're studying the solar system and they're coming up with these models. You have Jonas Kepler, born in 1571, dies in 1630, who studies the orbitals of the planet. And then this all kind of culminates in Isaac Newton, who's born in 1642 and dies in 1727. And he's coming up with like these laws of physics and stuff like that. And so they start slowly pushing the physics yardstick forward. You can see over these generations that, and the reason why that's kind of allowed, even though Galileo Galilei gets like ostracized by the church and stuff, but his ideas stay because they don't actually directly contradict the Bible, because the Bible doesn't mention space.
Yeah, we love something that doesn't contradict the Bible.
We love something that doesn't contradict the Bible.
It makes everyone's lives so much easier.
Too true. So at the time, even though God created the world in like some days, and there's a little bit of like, hey, how can the solar system do this? Or how can we be that old? You know, they can kind of say like, well, a God day is not the same length as a human day, you know, and the Bible never.
Oh my God.
Right? Yeah. So there's all these kind of loopholes that allows physics to kind of move the yardstick forward, because they're not, it's not directly contradicted by the Bible. You know, the Bible doesn't directly mention planets or anything like that. So we can kind of like fudge the rules so it still fits in with what we think.
I wonder how long a God day is.
That's a good question. How, honestly, like,
is it like millions of years?
Probably. Like,
it has to be.
How old the Earth is, and then God made Earth, and like, he made man at some point during the 7 days. Right? So like, it would have to be millions of years.
Yeah. Wow.
Right? So physics starts going forward. But at the same time, so I'm going to tell you about this guy, Reverend John Ray. And Reverend John Ray is very, he's like the big biology science man at the time. That is the technical term in case you were wondering. And you can tell he's a scientist because he's a reverend.
Yeah. That's how I always tell my scientists apart from my regular people.
Yeah, right? That's how you know he's studying biology. So he's born in 1627, which is just like 20 years before Isaac Newton. So like him and Newton, let's say, are making these scientific discoveries at the same time. And while Newton is finding the laws of physics, Reverend John Ray is listing animals that existed. He's adding them to the great chain of being. He's just saying like, yep.
Biology was so easy at one point in time.
Right? All you had to do was name shit.
I'm at the top of my field. That's a cat.
Yeah. Essentially it. That's all you had to do.
Amazing.
The biggest progress in biology at that time was Carl Linnaeus, and he invented the basic system to name organisms by observing So he invented the whole, like, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, which is, for anyone who's not in science, that's just a way to like, classify different organisms.
Which, I mean, is pretty dope. Like, I know it doesn't totally work out sometimes because there's just so many things to account for, but, like, it is pretty cool.
Oh, it's a very dope system, and we still use it now, and we still have naming practices based on this system. But that is the most groundbreaking kind of discovery in biology is I came up with a system to name things, you know. So that's right. That's kind of the comparison here, where we're at
while Newton is over there figuring out how gravity works.
Yeah, basically, Newton's like, oh, gravity, there's this invisible force.
Right. So biologists really need to catch up at this point.
They really need to catch up, and they've been stunted because they can do almost nothing without getting a lot of backlash. So we're just going to mention one or two guys now before Darwin. The only two guys I want to mention before Darwin now is Robert Chambers, who's born in 1802. He dies in 1872. And he anonymously publishes Vestiges of Natural History of Creation in 1844. So it's very important that he publishes this anonymously because he has these scientific ideas, but he knows that publishing them under his name is just going to destroy his entire life, right? He'll just be totally quote-unquote debunked by the church and just destroyed. So he publishes anonymously. And what this is, it's a work based on the fossil evidence that's been gathered to try and identify the animals we currently have versus the animals that used to exist. So all he does is he suggests that some animals stay on Earth and some go extinct. Therefore, there's like this shifting or this advancement in organisms. Because looking at the fossils, he sees that some animals that are in these fossils don't exist anymore. So he's suggesting that somehow organisms on Earth shift.
Right, which would be groundbreaking. But I wouldn't see the church being able to be like, whoa now.
Oh no, oh, they hated it.
Of course they did, but that just shows, like, they weren't actually thinking. They were just like, nope.
Yeah, so they were just reacting to whatever didn't fit exactly with the Bible. And even Robert Chambers, he was trying to, like, you can see in his publication that he's trying to, like, be friends with the church at the same time, because he says there's a clear shifting and advancement in animals, but suggests that this is not random because it was God's plan. So he says this must be God has made this mechanism. It is not a random process. It is being, like, pushed by God, but, you know, I have all this evidence that I've collected over my life, so I'm trying to actually publish it, you know?
Right.
So he publishes that, and that's, like, that's hated. They're like, oh, you scoundrel, you know? So Robert Chambers publishes anonymously. They do figure out it's him, and the church is just very, very angry that this book came out. All this time when other scientists are publishing these things and getting, like, hated on, Darwin is collecting evidence for what's going to become the origin of species. Like, Darwin is a nervous man. Like, it's very well documented that he has a lot of, like, anxieties, he had a weak stomach. What's more is that his wife is super, super religious. Darwin himself is a religious man. His wife is very, very religious. And so he starts having this idea that, like, organisms change and there's this thing where they adapt to the environment, but he doesn't want to publish because he doesn't want to affect his wife's life. He doesn't want to affect his life. He has children. So he just starts gathering evidence for a long time.
This actually makes him so much cooler to me because I remember learning about him in high school and being like, yeah, he was just a cool dude. He found all this stuff out. It's like, it's actually so much more interesting that, like, he had all these external pressures and yet it was like, nah, man, I need to publish it because, like, it's too important not to.
Yeah. Yeah. I have so many cool facts about, like, cool kind of fun tidbits about Darwin, and I'm going to tell you them. So one of the things that I think was cool about Darwin is that his grandfather was also kind of a scientist, but became a poet. And in his poetry, you see Darwin's grandfather basically suggests evolution. And
oh my God.
Like, in his poems, he suggests that we all come from this one, like, main organism, not evolution precisely, because this is a poem, it does not have the evidence, it doesn't have, like, it's not a theory, doesn't suggest a theory. But Darwin's grandfather was this scientist, and he observed this trend, but because he knew that the church would totally vilify him if he published, Darwin's grandfather became a poet. Because as a poet, you can kind of say these transgressive things and you can say these, like, wild, wacky things. And everyone's just like, oh, those wild poets, you know?
That's so, Darwin's, so cool.
Yeah, right. Darwin's grandfather starts publishing poetry that starts, like, suggesting that we all come from common ancestors, or starts suggesting these kind of, like, ideas. There's no evidence. It's not a good scientific theory. It's not a good scientific hypothesis. You know what I mean? Like, it's, but right. He's suggesting these ideas, and the reason he's able to publish them is because he publishes them under poetry.
Yeah, that's so cool. And, like, that's the type of thing where you just get people's minds thinking. So maybe, no, he wasn't the person who actually published, like, what's going on, but he was what inspired other people to actually go with it.
Yeah, exactly. So there are so many, like, at this time we think, like, oh, Darwin is the one, and he is. Darwin published with the evidence, and that is what matters. Like, I'm not taking anything away from Darwin, but even at the time you can see the forces of, like, other scientists trying to find ways to express these things that they are observing, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So it's this really super toxic environment. So Darwin just keeps going to the Galapagos, he keeps getting evidence, and he keeps coming back. And one of my favorite little facts that I learned, this is from a Darwin documentary that my brother first told me about, that I went and found it to, like, fact check it, but is that Darwin kept, there was this one type of turtle on the Galapagos, it was like the sea turtle, and Darwin kept trying to bring home a species of the sea turtle to put it in the museum. But the sea turtle was supposedly so delicious
that Darwin's
crew kept eating it before they got home.
Oh, I hate that.
Twice they tried to bring the sea turtle back, but they wound up eating it because it was too delicious.
No, why? Why would you even look at a sea turtle and be like, I bet that's tasty.
Turtle soup, man. Turtle soup.
No, I'm not into it.
I'm just saying. I think that's hilarious. Darwin is a great scientist, but he keeps eating his specimens. Like, that's so fucking funny.
It's very funny. You're right. It is.
Okay, so Darwin is collecting this mass. He's putting off publishing by saying, like, no, I need more evidence. He doesn't need more evidence at this point. So he's got like so much data, but he keeps collecting data because he doesn't want to publish for all these toxic kind of social reasons.
Right.
So what the fact that really forces Darwin to publish is Alfred Wallace. Alfred Wallace was born in 1823 and dies in 1913. Alfred Wallace travels, he is a museum specimen collector, so he travels around the world getting these, like, rare animals to put in museums, essentially. So Alfred Wallace starts traveling to these remote islands, and he starts to notice that the islands he visits are very close together, right, but they have such drastically different biodiversity. Right? And so he's like, wow, these islands are, like, in the same area, but because they're, like, isolated from each other, their biodiversity is so different. So he starts to kind of theorize, and then supposedly one night, he gets this tropical fever, and he asks, why do some animals thrive and some die? And he comes up with this idea that some animals thrive based on their ability to prosper in the environment which they are born, and the unfit will pass away, and so the fit will survive. So basically, it's this, like, watered down version of evolution. It's this idea that, like, based on the environment around them, some animals will prosper and some will die based on how well they fit the environment.
I really wish my fever dreams were that inspiring.
Right? I have a fever dream and I'm like, oh, whoa, I invented a new flavor of ice cream or some shit. You know, like, not my fever dreams are these scientific
stars. I had a giant
stars.
Spider spitting acid at me while I was on a roller coaster. Like, that's my fever dream.
I mean, that is wild.
It's an idea for a theme park ride.
Yeah, there you go. Not quite scientific theory, but
no.
Theme park. So Alfred Wallace wakes up from his fever dream and he writes this letter. And of course, because at the time, all the, like, British scientists kind of knew each other. So he writes this letter to Darwin and he sends it to Darwin. And Darwin goes like, oh. Fuck. Like, I've been collecting this data for years. This is my theory. And now this dude has thought of it. Like, oh, fuck. So what they do is they go and they have this, like, big kind of trial and they present their thing. And basically, because Darwin has all this evidence and has, like, he has so much evidence. He has so much data. And so they're like, yes, Darwin, you should publish this. This is your idea. You did have it first, you know, like, creds to Alfred Wallace, but, like, Darwin, this is your baby. So Darwin publishes. In 1859, Darwin publishes. He publishes The Origin of the Species. And the scientific community, I should say, the scientific community accepts this almost immediately. He publishes it with so much data, and so, like, because he's been, like, procrastinating,
right? He's been procrastinating and just getting more absolutely. And more like prove it's right. So he publishes it and it's like, yeah, this is great. This is really well done. This is like very all encompassing. Yes, love it.
Which, in its own way, maybe he was kind of being scared to publish, but at the same time, like waiting until you have a lot of data to finally present it is a lot more evidence-based and it's harder for people to refute.
Yeah, exactly. So it did definitely pay off. Like, his nervousness did pay off. And I should note that when Darwin publishes, he publishes with that same idea of, like, he's like, these things happen, like, animals do evolve, and I'll explain what that means in a bit. But he also says, this could still be God's plan. Like, he doesn't discount religion. He says, I believe in God. I believe that this mechanism is so beautiful. Like, it's so intricate. It's so, like, that God created it. You know what I mean? God hit the start button, and then the program ran, you know? He's not saying that God guides evolution. He's saying that God invented the mechanism that animals can evolve through, right?
He found a way to help the church be on his side.
Yes. And so, of course, with this explanation, the religious community sees his work and rejects it wholeheartedly. They are like, no!
Never! You get that filthy nonsense out of your mouth right now.
Exactly. So just kind of a fun thing is that, as I mentioned, Darwin is very, very nervous man. He's like very anxious. So he actually, there's this other scientist called Thomas Huxley, and Thomas Huxley kind of takes it upon himself to be like, they start calling him Darwin's bulldog because he takes it upon himself to like do the debates and like do all the public appearances and like defend Darwin's work, and because Darwin is too anxious to do it himself, so this other guy Thomas Huxley comes and he's like, I got you, bro. Like, it's like the extrovert introvert, like, I'm gonna protect my little introvert. So Darwin gets this bulldog who like starts like defending his work publicly and stuff like that, and kind of helping him go through this religious rejection. So now I would like to talk about what Darwin publishes and his theory and stuff like that, but before we do that, we just kind of have to briefly go over like how genetics works, because all of this is very dependent on understanding how things get passed on, what it means to like have genetics encoded. So now we have to just briefly step away from Darwin. We will be back, but we just have to talk about genes. And at the time, Darwin does, like, genes are not known. There's actually this dude, Gregor John Mendel, who's born in 1822 and dies in 1884, and he gets it right in terms of like genes and inheritance. Yeah, he's the, like, the, if you're in bio, he's the green pea, yellow pea guy.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, yeah, he breeds plants and he watches what baby plants get produced, and he goes like, oh, I think some things are passed down through generations. And he's a mathematician, so he kind of like graphs out genealogy mathematically very accurately. Like, he gets it right. And later on, they show that like Darwin had a copy of Mendel's work in his library, but almost no one reads his work, and so his work kind of gets lost because he's a mathematician and no one understands it. Like, he writes it as, yeah. So when Darwin publishes his theory, he publishes this like pseudo explanation for how things get passed on called philology or some shit like that. Like, it's totally wrong. He thinks like, oh, things mush together and form like if you mix like red and white and you get pink, you know. So he publishes something, he's like, I don't really know how this works, here's how it might work, you know. And that's not the point of his theory, so it doesn't matter. But what I find hilarious is that Gregor John Mendel figured it out, published it, but because it was in like mathematician language, no one read it or understood it.
Oh, poor Mendel.
I know. So Mendel's work kind of gets rediscovered like 50 years after he publishes it, because people start to go back and be like, hey, this guy got it right, you know?
Yeah, and he did it too. Like, I've always, whenever we talked about that, because I think the first time we looked at that was grade 11 or something, and I remember just like looking at his process of like how he figured it out, like with the different pea plants, and like how he's like, okay, well, let's try breeding this one with this one. I'm like, wow, you were a, like, true scientist before people had, like, the systems they have now.
Yeah. He very much approached it with this, like, mathematician, like, okay, we go, like, X plus Y, observe the results, you know, and, like, repeat the study, and, like, yeah. Like, he approached it very intelligently, and he cracked the code, you know what I mean? Like,
like, it worked. Like, he knew it.
Yeah. So let's talk about genes a little bit. Let's first talk about the fact that everyone's body has what's called germline cells and somatic cells. And those are pretty fancy words, Quincy, but you know what they mean.
Well, basically, germline cells are the sex cells. So they are the cells, like egg and sperm, used in reproduction. So they pass our genes from one generation to the next, while somatic cells are just all the other cells in the body.
Yeah, so the somatic cells are basically your body cells. Like, if you look at your hands and your arms and everything that, like, those are somatic cells. Everything that's in you is somatic cells, except for, like, if you're a woman, your eggs, or if you're a guy, your sperm. So, yeah, so germline cells are cells that become gametes, become embryos, like, that get passed on. And somatic cells are just the cells that make up you and that you will not necessarily pass on.
They're determined from, like, what's going on in the germline cells.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. But, like, for example, so my skin cells are somatic cells. If I develop skin cancer, that's a cancer in my somatic cells. If I have a baby, she's not going to necessarily have she's not going to have skin cancer, right? Because I have a cancer in my somatic cells, so that's not going to get passed on. It's like what affects my somatic cells affects me as an organism, but is not going to affect my babies.
For sure, yes.
Yeah, so we have germline cells and somatic cells, and then within all of our cells, we have this thing called DNA. And DNA is basically this blueprint that we all possess. And everyone's DNA is unique to them because it encodes your genes. It's this blueprint for how your body expresses itself. So within DNA, which is just this long strand, it's in every cell's nucleus, it are these things called genes. There are these little sections within DNA of these, like, kind of building blocks. It's made up of amino acids and shit. You don't really need to understand that. But
I had a good teacher who was like, what a gene is, like a word, and then the gene goes into, like, a chromosome, which is, like, a sentence. And then the chromosome is, like, your full DNA, which is, like, your book. And so it was, like, it's the building blocks. Yeah, like, so exactly what you just said. Your gene is a building block that leads to how your entire book of yourself is created.
That's perfect. That is exactly right. You have this book, and some of the book is going to be nonsense gibberish. Like, it's just going to be letters, and that's stuff that doesn't encode for a gene. It doesn't mean anything. It's just there because of a mutation or an accident or something like that. And then you'll have these, like, functional words that will encode for stuff. So you'll have a gene that tells your body how to, like, what color to make your hair. You'll have a gene that tells your body what color to make your skin. You'll have a gene that tells your body, like, how to make your lungs, you know? So you have these, basically this super, super long instruction manual. And within that, there's, like, chapters and sections and stuff like that. That's perfectly, you described that beautifully.
Thank you.
You're welcome. and so just the basic idea of how we pass on traits is there is, within organisms, there's asexual reproduction and there's sexual reproduction. Obviously, humans propagate via sexual reproduction. And so, and asexual reproduction is like amoebas and stuff like that. They'll basically duplicate themselves and they'll create an identical copy of themselves. So the same genes, asexual reproduction results in the same genes, the same, like, you make a copy of yourself.
Which, can you imagine, like, if every couple months or something, we just split in two and all of a sudden there were two of us?
That would be so funny.
Can you imagine? It would be crazy.
Like, I had a baby and it's like, you?
It's like, oh God, here it comes.
It's not even like a baby version of you. It's just like you as you are now.
Yeah, and you just, yeah, like, you. You're looking at yourself and you're like,
like my child. So humans, obviously, sexual reproduction is our thing. And why sexual reproduction is important is it combines DNA of your father and your mother, right? So you are a genetic combination of your parents. So you inherit some of their some of your mom's genes, you inherit some of your dad's genes.
The good and the bad.
The good and the bad. The good, the bad, and the ugly. In inheriting these genes from both sides of the parents, your genes interact in different ways with each other, right? So the only thing I'm going to get into right now is recessive versus dominant traits. And I'm going to talk about hair color and eye color because it's the easiest one to think about. So I'm going to talk about my parents and me. So I have blue eyes and blonde hair, right? My mother has brown hair and brown eyes. My father has red hair and blue eyes.
So I am a combination of their genes. And how that works is that some genes are what's called recessive and some genes are what's called dominant. So I'm going to receive a copy of my hair color gene from my mother, and I'm going to receive a copy of a hair color gene from my father. And what my hair color is going to depend on how those genes interact. So things like brown hair is what's called a dominant gene. So if I receive a copy of a brown hair gene from my mom and a blonde hair gene from my dad, the dominant gene, the brown hair, is going to kind of hide the recessive gene. So if I receive one copy of brown hair gene, I'm going to have brown hair. Doesn't matter if my other copy is like redhead or blonde, doesn't matter. Brown hair is dominant. Brown hair is going to be what's expressed. So I'm going to have brown hair.
Yeah, this goes to show like the two levels, which you're breaking down more simply, but basically there's the genotypic level and then the phenotypic level. So genotype mm-hmm. is the actual genes that you possess, and the phenotype is how they are expressed and visually like are seen to the world.
Exactly, yeah. So if we look at my mother and my father and me, I have recessive traits. I have blonde hair, so I have to have two copies, right? So my genotype is blonde hair. I have double blonde hair copy. My phenotype is I have blonde hair. But my mother, who gave me a blonde hair copy and has brown hair herself, her genotype is that she has one copy of blonde hair, one copy of brown hair, but her phenotype is that she has brown hair.
Yeah, right? So exactly.
Yeah, so how she's encoded, like what her DNA blueprint says is not necessarily what's expressed. Her DNA blueprint says one of each. What's expressed is just the brown hair.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so that's the basic idea, and the kind of implied thing there is that, but another thing that can happen is the environment around you can interact with the genotype and affect the phenotype. So your genotype will not change. Whatever you're born with, your DNA, it will not change. There's no way to change the DNA that you're already born with. Mm-hmm. But there's a way to change how it expresses itself. So that's like the type of thing where people say, like things can get triggered, right? So you have a predisposition, they call it a genetic predisposition. So let's say you have a genetic predisposition for depression and you're fine, but then an inciting incident, so like you experience this traumatic event and or something like that, something triggers it from the outside, the environment around you triggers it, and then it starts getting expressed. So then you start to feel depressed. Or things like cancers, you could have a predisposition towards certain type of cancers encoded in your genetic makeup, and you live a super healthy life, you don't smoke, anything like that, it never gets expressed. Whereas your sibling smokes all day long and it triggers their genetic predisposition and they get lung cancer. So it's this whole idea that you have a genotype, which is encoded in you and cannot change. You have a phenotype, which is how you look or what's expressed, and the environment can change how your genes get expressed. So it can affect your phenotype.
Yeah, totally. And then there's one other situation, which I don't know if you were going to get into or not, but then, so you get your parents' DNA, but the thing is sometimes when their gametes are being formed, they're the germline cells that are going to go on to become these gametes that will then become you. They sometimes get mutations. So it's not exactly what your parents have necessarily. And that mutation, though, will get passed to you, and that mutation can be good or bad, depending on how it ends up, where it ends up being affected, or it might not show at all because there's all this nonsense genetic coding that doesn't have anything to do with your genetic makeup.
Yeah, exactly. And so we have this kind of idea in, I think the larger kind of media, that like mutations in your mom thing, they're like, he's mutated and stuff like that. And like, mutations are so common. Everyone has mutations in their DNA.
Totally.
Everyone does. And you develop mutations and stuff like that. You develop mutations in your somatic cells. And if you develop mutations in your somatic cells, you're not going to pass those on. But if you develop mutations in your gametes, in your like eggs or your sperm, those will be passed on to your child, right? But most mutations don't do anything, because a lot of our DNA is this kind of like, this used to be a gene that we use, but it's turned off now, or this is just like gibberish that we don't really know how it works.
It's almost like the word jumble in the paper. Like, you've got all these letters, yeah, and some of them form actual sentences, but some of them are just there to mess you up.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So everyone has mutations in their DNA. everyone gets them over the course of their life. There are things that can make them appear faster. There are things that can, like, slow this, you know, but everyone gets mutations. So actually that brings us kind of a nice way to start talking about Darwin's theory, because when Darwin publishes The Origin of Species, it's basically the whole thing is his idea is the variation theory of change. It's his big idea. He calls it the variation theory of change, which is that it's attempting to describe the way that over the course of generations, organisms will change. And that's one of the very important parts about evolution is people think like, oh, I'm going to mutate and then evolve. And like, no. You as an individual organism don't evolve, because evolution happens over the course of generations. Yeah, so it's not about how you change. It's about how what you pass on to your babies.
Yeah, your genotype is set. Like, it is the way it is. Their genotype is what is going to be different.
Exactly. So the variation theory of change says that there are two things that affect this. So the first is a random process. So organisms within a population show variation, and some of this variation will be inheritable and passed on to offspring, but the variation is random. So the things that affect this are sexual reproduction, what's called crossing over, which I'll explain in a second, and mutations, which we just discussed. So those are all random processes. Mutations occur randomly. Sexual reproduction, you don't choose which particular sperm cell fertilizes which egg you drop when you have a baby, right? So that's a random process. Mm-hmm. And each egg and each sperm cell has your DNA, but it, you know, you're going to pass on, like, if I have two copies of blonde gene, I'm going to pass on two copies of blonde gene each one. But like my mother, some of her eggs passed on a brown-haired copy, because my siblings are brown-haired, and some of her eggs passed on a blonde-haired copy. So whichever copies of your genes you pass to your kid is random. That's sexual reproduction. You choose one of your two copies and you pass it on.
Yeah, right? Elsa, I guess I didn't think about it, but your genetics are kind of rare for your parents.
Yeah. Yeah, we did a thing in like grade 11 where there was a whole list of traits and you had to like check off the recessive ones and which ones you had and stuff. And I'm actually ridiculously recessive. Like when I have a baby, they're going to look nothing like me. Like all of my traits are recessive. So I need two copies on all my traits, which means I'm going to pass on those copies, but it also means that like all traits are going to dominate me, you know?
You just need to find someone more recessive than you.
Oh my god, they're gonna have to be like a ghost.
Yeah. Just a ghost.
Just a ghost.
Just ghost genetics.
Everything's dominant over ghost genetics. Lord, we do have fun.
But honestly, I can see you with like a Casper-esque ghost and like you just being like, yeah, this is my lifestyle now.
This is my baby daddy, yeah. Just be like, oh my god, that'd be so funny. Then anytime he says something that like, or I mean, I suppose he, if I'm gonna reproduce, anytime they say something that's gonna like contradict what I say, I'm just be like, oh, sorry, did you hear something? No, I'm just gonna walk out of this
room. You don't exist.
You don't really exist. Oh man, that's the life. That's really the goal.
That's the goal. I don't actually know. That is not the goal.
Anyway, so this other thing that can happen during sexual reproduction is what's called crossing over. And that just, it makes your genes just a little more random. And what that is that during the process of, within your own gametes, when you're like making eggs or making sperm or whatever, it kind of like, the process of making eggs, the process of making sperm, it divides up your chromosomes so that you're only giving half of your genetic load to your baby, so that the other person you're having a baby with can give their half of their genetic load, and that makes one full genetic load. You know what
also,
I mean?
While we're speaking about the production of eggs, it has the coolest name ever. It's called oogenesis.
You're right. That is, I should use the name. Oogenesis. Yeah. That is a good name. Yeah, so during oogenesis... Your egg only has half your genetic material so that the other person can like complete it and get one baby. And so what happens is when you're dividing up your chromosomes, sometimes they cross over and they kind of mix and match their DNA. And unless you really understand DNA and stuff like that, so this is not going to fully make sense. That's okay. Just it's another thing that kind of randomizes what genes you're going to discover, or you're going to inherit. Sorry. So it's just these three, sexual reproduction, crossing over, mutations, are just random factors that just shake up your genetic makeup a little bit, make it a little more random.
Yeah. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes it ends up with you having depression.
Yeah. It's a mixed bag. So what Darwin says is these are the random process that further variation in organisms, but then there's a not random process. So that's individuals with traits that are advantageous to local conditions will experience increased survival and reproduction, therefore increasing the frequency of that trait in the following generations. So that's a very fancy way of saying this is the whole survival of the fittest. And what's important here is fittest does not mean like most in shape or most like this or most. Fittest literally just means you're the best at reproducing. So the fittest means you are the best at leaving behind genetic copies of yourself. And so what Darwin's saying is that the organisms that suit the environment most effectively, so like there's variations and change within a population, right? Some of us are redheads, some of us are brunettes, some of us are blah, 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 blah. So the traits that are naturally different within a population that are most attuned to the environment that those organisms live in are the ones that will survive the longest and have the most babies. So that's basically the idea that nature, the environment, selects advantageous traits and allows those organisms that have those traits to prosper and have more babies. So it's not that me as an organism changes to nature within my lifespan. It's that in the environment I live in, if I have traits that really fit in that environment, I'm going to prosper within my population. I'm going to have the most babies. And slowly over time, that trait of mine that's beneficial becomes the majority of the population.
Yeah, so say you've got your polar bears, right? And where they live is really, really cold. So they have a layer of blubber, like a thick layer of blubber, and they've got their lots of hair. And so they have become adapted to this really extreme, harsh, cold environment. But say you plop a polar bear into like Africa or something where it's really, really hot, they're not going to do so well.
They're not going to do so well, right? And if you plop a population in a new environment, right, the polar bears that were the fattest and had the thickest fur who were doing the best in the Arctic are no longer, they're going to do the worst in the desert, right?
Like, exactly.
So it really shows that the traits within themselves are not good or bad. It's just it's the traits that are the most adept for the environment you're in that's going to prosper.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So Darwin publishes this, and then we have another scientist, Mayer, in 1982. And scientists love it, religion hates it. People are like, this sucks. So Mayer in 1982 kind of takes Darwin's work and he just writes it out a little more simply because he sees that Darwin actually has these five major theories. And so he just rewrites them a little bit. So it just makes it a little simpler. So Mayer writes that Darwin has written about evolution. So his first idea is evolution. The idea that organisms evolve, not a new idea, right? We talked about water and organisms changing and some organisms dying and fossil records and that. So it's not a new idea, but Darwin brings it with a whole new level of competence and evidence. So evolution, Darwin gets the credit there because it's not necessarily the newest idea, but Darwin is the one who brings the evidence to it and the competence and the description.
Right.
The other idea is common descent. So we all come from a common ancestor, right? That's also not a new concept. Remember, but way back in 4th century BC, we had our dude being like, we all come from water. So again, not a new idea, but presented with better evidence. Then there's the idea of gradualness. And so that's the idea that change comes gradually in small steps. So it's not that one organism mutates and becomes better. It's those mutations are small, they occur over the course of generations. So this change happens over generations. It's gradual change. And then these are the two really, really new ideas that Darwin is like the first to kind of say. One is population speciation. So that's the idea that the change occurs at a population level, because everything else was very individual centered, right? It's me, it's how I change, it's like the whole concept, especially like with the religious influence, it's like about the individual, right? But right. Darwin comes up with this theory of evolution and he's like, it's not about the individual. The individual actually has almost no like part in this. It's about the population. So we have to study populations.
Well, yeah, that's
and the
like,
last thing that
yeah. What was the guy who said that it the way we evolve is through use and disuse. And so if you disuse, if you don't use something, it becomes smaller, but if you use something, it becomes larger. So hence, like, we have giraffes with crazy long necks because they need to reach into trees so their necks grow longer, and then you pass on your longer neck to the next generation.
Yeah, so that was an idea that came actually after Darwin had time to explain it.
Oh, and it was after. Interesting.
It was I know, it was wild. It was after, and it kind of got debunked, right? Because it's that whole idea that, like, if I use my, like, that's like when you apply it to humans, you immediately see how it doesn't work. You're like, yes, if I stretch my neck, it would grow longer. And it's like, no, like, yeah, like, you can build your muscles by lifting weights, but you're not gonna, like, lengthen the length of your neck by, like, looking up.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, like, but, like, that's just, like, an example of people who thought that it happened within your generation. It was a me.
Yeah, exactly. So Darwin presents this idea that's not the individual, and people before and people after are like, maybe this isn't quite true, and it, when it turns out, it's like, no, it was true. Yeah, you should have listened. And then the last new idea, this is Darwin basically was the first to say this, this part is the mechanism of evolution is natural selection. So that is a new mechanism through which evolution occurs, where the environment selects for the fittest traits. So it's not about the individual. It's not about how much the individual loves his long neck, you know, that's going to determine whether or not the long neck gets passed on. It's the environment you're in is going to select for the best traits. And so that is a new idea that the church hates. They're like, how dare you suggest that this cold lump of rock that we call Earth has more agency over one grand being deciding who gets to live and die. You know, they hate the idea that nature selects for traits.
Right. I mean, it's so funny to hear it discussed that way too, because, like, when I was in church, when I was a kid, they were clearly, like, it had come to a point where science had too much evidence. And so they were like, listen, like, yeah, nature selects, but it's God's selection.
Right? Yeah. So that's the thing. It's like, oh, okay. How can we like gymnastics this into, like, being, and, you know, like, I am not against the idea of believing in God. I know I was raised Catholic and I don't personally buy it, but, like, God and evolution are not conflicting concepts. Like,
no.
The idea that God started this process and created a world where, like, he created a world where organisms could adapt, but, like, he created the mechanism of adapting. He created the environment. Like, that is an idea that can very easily rest next to evolution, right? Like, they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
And I don't think they have to be.
No, I don't think so either.
So over the years, I'm not going to list these off because they get very detailed and very, like, I'd have to explain, like, 17 different things. But over the years, experimental genetics, mathematical models of population genetics and natural historians, systematists and taxonomists, which is just, like, physiology of animals, and paleontologists all discover things that support evolution. So basically, over the next, like, hundreds of years, every single scientific field that has to do with biology, everything they discover supports the theory of evolution. So it's just like Darwin had a bunch of evidence, and now nothing that we've discovered since has contradicted it, which is huge.
So sick.
Yeah, like the fact that someone says something that hasn't been, like, even now, I think we've recently discovered something that contradicts one of Einstein's theories, you know what I mean? And that doesn't take away at all from Einstein being a genius and stuff like that, but it's like, yeah, we've discovered something that contradicted these rules of physics that we thought were, like, the fact that we haven't discovered anything that contradicts evolution is, like, huge.
It's crazy.
That is evidence within itself, yeah.
Especially since, like, biology is so diverse and, like, it seems like it's always changing, and yet it's always changing to the same rules.
Yeah. So, yeah, and one of the reasons why, like, we only have, like, a few new discoveries in chemistry and physics and stuff like that, but biology is, like, we discover new things every single friggin' day, is what I talked about, is the fact that, like, for so long, the study of biology just wasn't really allowed. You just had to, like, list animals, you know, and
right.
We're like, we're playing catch up, you know, we're like, we're still discovering a bunch of stuff, and yet it still all supports, which is why it's so fun. Yeah, I know, I love it. So that kind of brings us to where are we now? After this, I'm gonna get into like some really cool specific examples of evidence for evolution. I'm gonna give like a little concept and then an example of a study that, and it's gonna be super cool. But right now, so I found a few polls. One of them is from 2019, but I don't trust the sourcing that much. And so the other one's from 2008, and I trust the sourcing much more. So I'm going to tell you the 2008 one first. But I found this study, or this survey, basically. According to a 2008 Angus Reid poll, 58% of Canadians believe humans evolved from earlier life forms. So almost 60%. 22% believe humans were created by God in this image that we are now. And another 20% said they were unsure. So as of 2008, we still have almost half our population, 42%, who aren't sure evolution is real, or just flat out are like, no, evolution's wrong, it was God.
Can I just say, I love that you're using Canadian statistics.
Thank you.
It's very exciting. I haven't heard a podcast ever that mentions Canadian statistics, so this is really great.
It's all U.S. statistics.
All American, yeah.
Oh, I know, and I was like, I'm in Canada, I want to know about Canada.
Yes,
so yeah, in 2019, a nationwide poll said that 61% of Canadians believe humans evolved. So like, we're going up, we went from 58 to 61. Not a huge leap, but like, And then it says 23% believe that gods created human beings, which is also a little bit of a leap, and then it doesn't say what the other percentage is because that doesn't add up to 100%. So, and it was done by this company called Research Co, which seems to be just like an online survey thing. And so I was like, that's bad. They didn't explain how they got their numbers. Their numbers don't add up to 100%. So that one's more recent, but I don't trust it. So I trusted the Angus Reid poll with the 58%. So even now in Canada, I feel like we're just like in high school, especially. I remember my high school teacher specifically didn't get into evolution because she didn't want to offend anyone. And I think the reason why so much of our population is like unsure or like flat out doesn't believe it, it's just because it's not taught in high school. And it's not like talked about for fear of like offending someone, rather than being taught in a way that like shows that all beliefs can be integrated into this fact, you know, because this is like, we've observed the world and we have noticed how the world works. This is something that is supported again and again. Denying it so as not to offend someone is not really going to progress our consciousness. Nothing's going to progress unless we are able to talk about it, you know?
Yeah, and like for far too long, like it has been opposing. It's like you have to decide one or the other. But there are so many scientists who are very religious. Like it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive when you're just looking at everything, all the facts, everything that you need, plus just adding in like, but if you're spiritual, that's fine.
Yeah, right? And like, it's from the beginning, I feel like it's not like we use Darwin, the man of science. Darwin was super religious. Darwin put off publishing because he was scared of offending the church. You know what I mean? Like,
whether we like it or not, science is integrated into religion because of how it progressed.
Yeah, heavily influenced. Absolutely. Yeah, so it's just that's where we are now, and that's where we're going. Hopefully the numbers will start going up, and as we become more accepting, because I do think that sometimes in super left, like super science-centered conversations, it can be a little bit like, it can be a little harsh, right? Like when you get to either extreme, it's a little harsh of like, you have to believe this and you can't believe anything else. And I feel like the like longer we go, the more we're just going to find common middle grounds and be like, hey, we can all believe this. We can all think this. We can all, you know what I mean? Like just finding places where everyone's comfortable.
Yeah, both sides have come to the table too upset and too harsh to each other, so we're not listening to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if someone insults one of my instinctive beliefs before telling me these facts, I'm not going to listen to the facts. I'm just going to be like, wow, you dick. Like, yeah.
You dick, yeah.
Right? I'm just going to shut down. Yeah, so I think one of the important things is to just, like, just lay it out. Just lay out why religion is so steeped in this idea of evolution, why, like, that's kind of why I gave the context, because I think it's important to see where we came from and why it became so hard to accept. Even now, it's so hard to accept. It's because of this, like, history, of this precedent, of this not knowing how to integrate the two things.
We got so deep there.
We did get so deep. Oh, Lord. Okay, so I have so much more to say. I have so much evidence now. We haven't even gotten really into natural selection. We've just mostly talked about evolution. I have examples. I have fun stuff. But, Quincy, we've been talking for so long. I think this is a very natural place to kind of end and be like, hey, everyone's welcome. And we will definitely have more episodes on this because I didn't even get into the Russian fox study. And the Russian fox study is so fun. So,
oh my God, we are going to have so much to talk about.
So much to talk about. So Quincy, at the end of my rants and my talking at you, could you please summarize for our gentle viewers, what is your takeaway from this episode?
Okay, so I think the takeaway from this episode should be that the process of life, the formation of new species, it's complicated. There's a lot going on, and it's constantly, like, these mutations, like, are constantly changing everything, and there's no one set pathway, really, to look at that's like, this is how everything happens. However, the fundamentals of evolution are always there. Whether you're a scientist or you're very religious, like, it's really hard to look at it and just say that no, there's no patterns. And you really need to look into these patterns and to see every bit of evidence that has been brought forth and make a real, like, decision based on that, rather than just putting it from your mind and saying, no, this can't be.
That was very, very well summed up. Yeah, I think the other thing is keep in mind the context. Keep in mind, like, the way we view evolution now is because of a long history of limiting biological study and stuff like that. So our history affects us now because those mentalities from the past carry forward. So it's just about, like, taking a step back and being like, okay, in today's day and age, knowing all the things that I know now, if I'm gonna, like, kind of look at this blank slate, look at this objectively, and I what information do I know to be true now, and what are my past preconceptions that are affecting this? And I think that's true for evolution, but I think that's also just a good mentality to go out into the world with, like, what in the past is affecting my view of the present.
Yeah, and just open your mind to all possibilities. Don't close down just because you're scared of what the possibilities are.
Yeah, absolutely, because you know what, there's almost always room for another belief there. Yeah, like, so much we think, like, you have to believe one thing or the other, and it's like, actually I could just pick all the parts I like and believe that, you know what I mean? Like, there's always room for another perspective.
Yeah.
All right, Quincy, I think we answered a lot of unasked questions today.
Yeah, we sure did.
Yeah, and I would just like to say thank you for coming, gentle viewer. We appreciate the two of you who
are listening. We love my family and Tom.
Shout out to Quincy's family. You guys are you're lifting Tom. Us up. And
you
Tom.
Can't forget, yeah, right. Tom.
Love you, babe.
Hi,
go.
Hi, Tom. This is a special hi to you.
This is a special hi for our one listener. Oh, I love it. Oh my God. Okay. Well,
all right, we'll see you next time. Oh my God, we said it at the same time.